that more often glamorized, the pursuit by the police was the dominant topic whenever two or more Panthers got together. In a crowded room, they buzzed with the story, often adding their own details. In truth, Rick was not being pursued. There was a warrant for his arrest for simple assault, a misdemeanor, and according to his new lawyer in Cleveland, no one was chasing him with handcuffs. The authorities knew where he was, and if he ever came to Cleveland again, he'd be prosecuted. Still, Rick was on the run, and the Panthers had to protect him, both on the field and off. Saturday proved to be as educational as Friday. Livy led him through the Teatro Reggio, a place he was extremely proud to have already seen, then the Diocesan Museum, the Church of San Marcellino, the Chapel of San Tommaso Apostolo. For lunch, they ate a pizza on the grounds of the Palazzo della Pilota. "I will not set foot in another church," Rick announced in defeat. He was stretched out on the grass, soaking in the sunshine.
"I'd like to see the National Gallery," she said as she curled next to him, tanned legs everywhere.
"What's in it?"
"Lots of paintings from all over Italy."
"No."
"Yes, then the Archaeological Museum."
"Then what?"
"I'll be tired then. We go to bed, take a nap, think about dinner."
"I have a game tomorrow. Are you trying to kill me?"
"Yes."
After 2 days of diligent tourism, Rick was ready for football, rain or not. He couldn't wait to drive past the old churches, go to the field, put on a uniform, then get it muddy, and maybe even hit someone.
"But it's raining," Livy cooed from under the sheets.
"Too bad, cheerleader. The show must go on." She rolled over and flung a leg across his stomach. "No," he said with conviction. "Not before a game. My knees are weak anyway."
"I thought you were the stud quarterback."
"Just the quarterback for now." She removed the leg and swung it off the bed.
"So who are the Panthers playing today?" she asked, standing, turning, enticing.
"The Gladiators of Rome."
"What a name. Can they play?"
"They're pretty good. We need to go." He parked her under the canopy on the home side, one of fewer than 10 fans there an hour before the game. She was covered in a poncho and huddled under an umbrella, more or less waterproof in the driving rain. He almost felt sorry for her. 20 minutes later, he was on the field in full uniform, stretching, bantering with his teammates, and keeping an eye on Livy. He was in college again, or maybe in high school, anxious to play for the love of the game, for the glory of winning, but also for a very cute girl up in the stands. The game was a mud bowl. The rain never stopped. Franco fumbled twice in the first quarter, and Fabrizio dropped 2 slippery passes. The Gladiators got bogged down as well. With a minute to go before the half, Rick scrambled out of the pocket and sprinted 30 yards for the first score of the game. Fabrizio bobbled the snap, and the score was 6-0 at the half. Sam, who had not had the chance to bitch and yell at them for 2 weeks, unloaded in the locker room, and everyone felt better. By the fourth quarter, water was standing in large puddles across the field, and the game became a slugfest at the line of scrimmage. On a 2nd and 2, Rick faked to Franco, faked to Giancarlo, the third-string tailback, and lofted a long, soft pass to Fabrizio, flying downfield on a post. He bobbled it, then snatched it, and ran 20 yards untouched. With a 2-touchdown lead, Sam began blitzing on every play, and the Gladiators couldn't get a first down. They racked up 5 for the entire game. Rick said goodbye to Livy at the train station Sunday night, then watched the Eurostar pull away with both sadness and relief. He had not realized the extent of his loneliness. He had been reasonably certain that he greatly missed the companionship of a woman, but Livy made him feel like a college boy again. At the same time, she was not exactly low maintenance. She demanded his attention and had a strong streak of hyperactivity. He needed some rest. Late Sunday email from his mother. "Dear Ricky, your father has decided that he will not make the trip to Italy after all. He is quite angry with you and that stunt in Cleveland. The game was bad enough, but now reporters are calling all the time asking about the assault and battery. I despise these people. I'm beginning to understand why you slugged that poor man in Cleveland. But you could have stopped by and said hello while you were here. We haven't seen you since Christmas. I would try to come alone, but my diverticulosis might be flaring up. Best if I stay close. Please tell me you'll be home in a month or so. Are they really going to arrest you? Love, Mom." She treated her diverticulosis like an active volcano, always down there in the colon awaiting an eruption in the event she was expected to do something she really didn't want to do. She and Randall had made the mistake 5 years earlier of traveling to Spain with a group of retirees, and they were still bitching about the cost, the air travel, the rudeness of all Europeans, the shocking ignorance of people who cannot speak English. Rick really didn't want them in Italy. Email back to his mother. Dear Mom, I'm so sorry you guys can't make it over, but the weather has been awful. I am not going to be arrested. I have lawyers working on things. It was just a misunderstanding. Tell Dad to relax. Everything will be fine. Life is good here, but I sure am homesick. Love, Rick. Late Sunday email from Arnie. Dear Turd, the lawyer in Cleveland has worked out a deal whereby you plead guilty, pay a fine, slap on the wrist. But if you plead guilty, then Craig can use that against you in a civil suit. He's claiming he has a broken jaw and is making noise about a suit. I'm sure all of Cleveland is egging him on. How would you like to face a jury in Cleveland? They'd give you the death penalty just for the assault, and they'll give Cray $1 billion in punitive in a civil suit. I'm working on it, not sure why. Rat cursed me yesterday for the last time, I hope. Tiffany gave birth early, and the child appears to be of mixed race. Guess you're off the hook. I am now officially losing money as your agent. Just thought you'd like to know that. Email back to Arnie. I love you, man. You're the greatest, Arn. Keep on keeping the vultures at bay. Mighty Panthers rolled today, shut out the Rome gladiators in a flood. Yours truly was magnificent. If Cray has a broken jaw, then he needs two. Tell him to sue me and I'll file for bankruptcy, in Italy. Let his lawyers chew on that. The food and women continue to astound. Thanks so much for skillfully guiding me to Parma. R.D. Email to Gabriella. Thanks for your kind note a few days ago. Don't worry about the episode in Florence. I've been stiffed by better women. No need to worry about future contact. Chapter 23. The pretty town of Bolzano is in the mountainous northeastern part of the country, in the Trentino Alto Adige region, a recent addition to Italy that was chipped away from Austria in 1919 by the Allies as a reward to the Italians for fighting the Germans. Its history is complicated. Its boundaries have been rigged and gerrymandered by whoever happened to have the larger army. Many of its residents consider themselves to be of Germanic stock, and certainly look like it. Most speak German first and Italian second, often reluctantly. Other Italians are known to whisper, "Those people aren't real Italians." Efforts to Italianize, Germanize, and homogenize the population all failed miserably. But over time, a pleasant truce evolved, and life is good. The culture is pure Alpine. The people are conservative, hospitable, and prosperous, and they love their land. The scenery is stunning. Ragged mountain peaks, lakeside vineyards and olive groves, valleys carpeted with apple orchards, and thousands of square miles of protected forests. Rick got all this from his guidebook. Livy, however, piled on the details. Since she had not been to the region, she had initially planned to make the trip. Exams, though, intervened. Plus, Bolzano was at least a 6-hour train ride from Florence. So she passed along her research in a series of windy emails. Rick scanned them as they arrived during the week, then left them on his kitchen table. He was much more concerned with football than with how Mussolini screwed up the region between the wars. And football was plenty to worry about. The Bolzano Giants had lost only once, to Bergamo, and by only 2 points. He and Sam had watched the film of the game twice and agreed that Bolzano should have won. A bad snap on an easy field goal made the difference. Bergamo. Bergamo. Still undefeated, the winning streak now at 66. Everything the Panthers did had something to do with Bergamo. Their game plan against Bolzano was impacted by their next game against Bergamo. The bus ride lasted 3 hours, and halfway through it, the landscape began to change. The Alps appeared to the north. Rick sat near the front with Sam, and when they weren't napping, they talked about the outdoors, hiking the Dolomites, skiing, and camping in the lake region. With no children, Sam and Anna spent weeks each autumn exploring northern Italy and southern Austria. Playing against the Giants. If Rick Dockery had one game to remember in his sad little tour of the NFL, It was against the Giants on a foggy Sunday night at the Meadowlands on national television in front of 80,000 raucous fans. He was with Seattle in his customary role as the number three quarterback. Number one got knocked out in the first half, and number two was throwing interceptions when he wasn't fumbling. Down 20 points late in the third, the Seahawks threw in the towel and called on Dockery. He completed 7 passes, all to his teammates, for 95 yards. 2 weeks later, he was on waivers. He could still hear the deafening roar of Giants Stadium. The stadium in Bolzano was much smaller and a lot quieter, but much prettier. With the Alps looming in the background, the teams lined up for the kickoff in front of 2,000 fans. There were banners, a mascot, chants, and flares. On the second play from scrimmage, the nightmare began. His name was Quincy Shoal, a thick tailback who once played at Indiana State. After the usual stints in Canada and arena ball, Quincy arrived in Italy 10 years earlier and found a home. He had an Italian wife and Italian kids and held almost all Italian records for running the football. Quincy rambled 78 yards for a touchdown. If anyone touched him, it would not be evident on the game film. The crowd went berserk. More flares and even a smoke bomb. Rick tried to imagine smoke bombs at the Meadowlands. Because Bergamo was next on the schedule and because Sam knew they were there scouting the game, he and Rick had decided to run the ball and downplay Fabrizio. It was a risky strategy, the kind of gamble Sam enjoyed. Both felt confident that the offense could pass at will, but they preferred to save something for Bergamo. Since Franco usually fumbled his first handoff each game, Rick called a pitch out to Giancarlo, a young tailback who had started the season as a third stringer, but was improving each week. Rick liked him primarily because he had a soft spot for third stringers. Giancarlo had a unique running style. He was small, 175 pounds or so, and not muscular at all, and he really didn't like to get hit. He had been a swimmer and diver as a young teenager and possessed quick and light feet. When faced with imminent contact, Giancarlo often hurled himself upward and forward, picking up additional yardage with each vault. His runs were becoming spectacular, especially the sweeps and pitch-outs that allowed him to build momentum before hurtling over tacklers. Sam had given him the advice every young runner gets in the seventh grade. Do not leave your feet. Lower your head, protect the ball, and by all means protect your knees, but do not leave your feet. Thousands of college careers had been ended suddenly by showy leaps over the pile. Hundreds of professional running backs had been maimed for life. Giancarlo had no use for such wisdom. He loved sailing through the air and was unafraid of a hard landing. He ran 8 yards to the right, then flew for 3 more. 12 to the left, including 4 from a half gainer. Rick bootlegged for 15, then called a dive to Franco. "Don't fumble," he growled as he grabbed Franco's face mask when they broke huddle. Franco, wild-eyed and psychotic, grabbed Rick's and said something nasty in Italian. Who grabs the quarterback's face mask? He didn't fumble, but instead lumbered for 10 yards until half the defense buried him at the Giants' 40. 6 plays later, Giancarlo soared into the end zone, and the game was tied. It took Quincy all of 4 plays to score again. "Let him run," Rick said to Sam on the sideline. "He's 34 years old." "I know how old he is," Sam snapped, "but I'd like to keep him under 500 yards in the first half." Bolzano's defense had prepared for the pass and was confused by the run. Fabrizio did not touch the ball until almost halftime. On a 2nd and goal from the 6, Rick faked DeFranco, bootlegged, and flipped it to his receiver for an easy score. A neat, tidy game. Each team had 2 touchdowns in each quarter. The noisy crowd had been thoroughly entertained. During halftime, the first 5 minutes inside a locker room are dangerous. The players are hot, sweating, some bleeding. They throw helmets, curse, criticize, scream, exhort one another to step it up and do whatever is not getting done. As the adrenaline slowly settles, they relax a bit, drink some water, maybe take off the shoulder pads, rub a wound or two. It was the same in Italy as it was in Iowa. Rick had never been an emotional player, and he preferred to hunker in the background and let the hotheads rally the team. Tied with Bolzano, he was not at all worried. Quincy Shoal's tongue was hanging, and Rick and Fabrizio had yet to play pitch and catch. Sam knew when to enter, and after 5 minutes he stepped into the room and took over the yelling. Quincy was eating their lunch. 160 yards, 4 touchdowns.
What a great strategy, Sam ranted. Let him run until he collapses. I've never heard of that before. You guys are brilliant,
and so on. As the season progressed, Rick was impressed more and more by Sam's tongue lashings. He, Rick, had been chewed out by many experts, and though Sam usually left him alone, he showed real talent when going after the others. And the fact that he could do it in 2 languages was awesome. But the locker room rave had little effect. Quincy, with a 20-minute rest and quick rubdown, picked up where he left off. Touchdown number 5 came on the Giants' first drive of the second half, and number 6 was a 50-yard gallop a few minutes later. A heroic effort, but not quite enough. Whether it was old age, 34, or too much pasta, or simply overuse, Quincy was finished. He stayed in the game until the end, but was too tired to save his team. In the fourth quarter, the Panthers' defense sensed his demise and came to life. When Pietro stuffed him on a 3rd-and-2 and flung him to the ground, the game was over. With Franco pounding the middle and Giancarlo bunny-hopping around the ends, the Panthers tied it with 10 minutes to go. A minute later, they scored again when Carl, the Dane, scooped up a fumble and wobbled 30 yards for perhaps the ugliest touchdown in Italian history. 2 tiny Giants rode his back like insects for the last 10 yards. For good measure, and to keep sharp, Rick and Fabrizio hooked up on a long post with 3 minutes on the clock. The final was 56-41. The locker room was far different after the game. They hugged and celebrated, and a few seemed on the verge of tears. For a team that only weeks earlier seemed listless and dead, they were suddenly close to a great season. Mighty Bergamo was next, but the Lions had to travel to Parma. Sam congratulated his players and gave them exactly 1 more hour to revel in the win. Then shut it off and start thinking about Bergamo, he said. 67 consecutive wins, 8 straight Super Bowl titles, a team we have not beaten in 10 years. Rick sat on the floor in a corner, his back to the wall, fiddling with his shoelaces and listening to Sam speak in Italian. Though he couldn't understand his coach, he knew exactly what he was saying. Bergamo this and Bergamo that. His teammates hung on every word, their anticipation already building. A slight wave of nervous energy swept over Rick, and he had to smile. He was no longer a hired gun, a ringer brought in from the Wild West to run the offense and win games. He no longer dreamed of NFL glory and riches. Those dreams were behind him now, and fading fast. He was who he was, a Panther, and as he looked around the cramped and sweaty locker room, he was perfectly happy with himself. Chapter 24. Much less beer was consumed Monday night during the film session. There were fewer wisecracks, insults, laughter. The mood wasn't somber. They were still quite proud of their road win the day before. But it was not the typical Monday night at the movies. Sam raced through the Bolzano highlights, then switched to a collage of Bergamo clips he and Rick had worked on all day. They agreed on the obvious. Bergamo was well-coached, well-financed, and well-organized, and had talent that was slightly above the rest of the league at some positions, but certainly not across the board. Their Americans were a slow quarterback from San Diego State, a strong safety who hit hard and would try to kill Fabrizio early in the game, and a cornerback who could shut down the outside running game, but was rumored to have a pulled hamstring. Bergamo was the only team in the league with 2 of their 3 Americans on defense. Their key player, though, was not an American. The middle linebacker was an Italian named Maschi, a flamboyant showman with long hair and white shoes, and a me-first attitude he'd copied from the NFL, where he happened to think he belonged. Quick and strong, Maschi had great instincts, loved a hit, the later the better, and was usually at the bottom of every pile. At 220 pounds, he was big enough to wreak havoc in Italy, and could have played for most Division I schools in the United States. He wore number 56, and insisted on being called LT to mimic his idol, Lawrence Taylor. Bergamo was strong defensively, but not overly impressive with the ball. Against Bologna and Bolzano, all those killer bees, they trailed until the fourth quarter, and could have easily lost both. Rick was convinced the Panthers were a better team. But Sam had been beaten by Bergamo so many times, he refused to be confident, at least in private. After 8 straight Super Bowl titles, the Bergamo Lions had achieved an aura of invincibility that was worth at least 10 points a game. Sam replayed the tape and hammered away at Bergamo's weaknesses on offense. Their tailback was quick to the line, but reluctant to lower his head and take a shot. They rarely passed until they had to, always on third down, primarily because they lacked a dependable receiver. The offensive line was big and fundamentally sound, but often too slow to pick up the blitz. When Sam finished, Franco addressed the team, and in superb lawyerly fashion, gave a rousing, emotional appeal for a hard, dedicated week, one that would lead to a mighty victory. In closing, he suggested that they practice every night until Saturday. The idea was unanimously approved. Then Nino, not to be outdone, took the floor and began by announcing that to show the gravity of the moment, he had decided to stop smoking until after the game, after they had thrashed Bergamo. This was greeted warmly because, evidently, Nino had made such a commitment before, and Nino, deprived of nicotine, was a frightening force on the field. Then he announced there would be a team dinner at Cafe Montana Saturday night, on the house. Carlo was already working on the menu. The Panthers were edgy with anticipation. Rick flashed back to the Davenport Central game, the biggest of the year for Davenport South. Starting on Monday, the school planned the entire week, and the town talked of little else. By Friday afternoon, the players were so anxious, some were nauseous and threw up hours before the game. Rick doubted if any Panther would be so overcome with nerves, but it was certainly possible. They left the locker room with a solemn determination. This was their week. This was their year. Thursday afternoon, Livy arrived in all her splendor and with a surprising amount of luggage. Rick had been at the field with Fabrizio and Claudio, working relentlessly on precision routes and quick audibles, when he took a break and checked his cell phone. She was already on the train. As they drove from the station to his apartment, he learned that she was, 1, finished with exams, 2, sick of her roommates, 3, thinking seriously of not returning to Florence for the final 10 days of her semester abroad, 4, disgusted with her family, 5, not speaking to anyone in her family, not even her sister, a person she had feuded with since kindergarten and who was now way too involved in their parents' divorce, 6, in need of a place to crash for a few days, thus the luggage, 7, worried about her visa because she wanted to stay in Italy for some vague period of time, and 8, really ready to hop in the sack. She wasn't whining, and she wasn't looking for sympathy. In fact, she covered her plethora of problems with a cool detachment that Rick found admirable. She needed someone, and she had fled to him. He hauled the remarkably heavy bags up the 3 flights and did so with ease and energy, happy to do so. The apartment was too quiet, almost lifeless, and Rick had found himself spending more time away from it, walking the streets of Parma, drinking coffee and beer at the sidewalk cafes, browsing the meat markets and wine shops, even taking quick detours through ancient churches, anything to keep away from the numbing tedium of his empty apartment. And he was always alone. Sly and Trey had left him, and his emails to them were rarely returned. It was hardly worth the trouble. Sam kept busy most days, plus he was married and had a different life. Franco, his favorite teammate, was good for lunch occasionally, but had a demanding job. All the Panthers worked. They had to. They could not afford to sleep until noon, spend a couple of hours in the gym, and roam around Parma killing time and earning nothing. Rick was not, however, in the market for a full-time live-in. That entailed complications and required a commitment that he had trouble even addressing. He had never lived with a woman, had not in fact lived with anyone since his days in Toronto, and he was not contemplating a full-time companion. As she unpacked, he wondered, for the first time, exactly how long she planned to stay. They postponed the lovemaking until after practice. It was to be a light workout, no pads, but he still preferred to have the full use of his legs and feet. Livy sat in the stands and read a paperback while the boys went through their drills and plans. There were a handful of other wives and girlfriends scattered about, even a few small children bouncing up and down the grandstand. At 10:30 Thursday night, a city employee arrived and made his presence known to Sam. His job was to turn off the lights. There were castles waiting. Rick first heard this news around 8 a.m., but managed to roll over and go back to sleep. Livy threw on her jeans and went to find coffee. When she returned in 30 minutes, with 2 large cups of takeaway, She announced again that castles were waiting, and she wanted to begin with one in the town of Fontanellato.
"It's very early," Rick said, taking a sip, sitting up in bed, trying to orient himself to such an odd hour.
"Have you been to Fontanellato?"
she asked as she removed the jeans, picked up a guidebook with her notes, and returned to her side of the bed.
I've never heard of it.
"Have you left Parma since you got here?"
"Sure. We had a game in Milan, one in Rome, one in Bolzano."
"No, Ricky, I'm talking about hopping in your little copper Fiat and sightseeing through the countryside."
"No. Why,
aren't you the least bit curious about your new home?"
"I've learned not to get attached to new homes. They're all temporary."
"That's nice. Look, I'm not lounging around this apartment all day having sex every hour and thinking about nothing but lunch and dinner."
"Why not?"
"I'm doing a road trip. Either you're driving or I'll catch a bus. There's too much to see. We're not even finished with Parma yet."
They left half an hour later and drove northwest in search of Fontanellato, a 15th-century castle Livy was desperate to inspect. The day was warm and sunny. The windows were down. She wore a short denim skirt and a cotton blouse, and the wind rushed across everything nicely and kept him engaged. He groped her legs, and she pushed him away with one hand as she read a guidebook with the other.
"They make 120,000 tons of Parmesan cheese here every year,"
she was saying as she looked at the countryside.
"Right here, on these farms."
"At least that much. These folks put it in their coffee."
500 dairies, all in a tightly defined area around Parma. It's regulated by law."
"They make ice cream out of it."
"And 10 million Parma hams a year. That's hard to believe."
"Not if you live here. They put it on your table before you sit down. Why are we talking about food? You were in such a hurry we got no breakfast."
She put her book down and announced,
"I'm starving."
"How about some cheese and ham?"
They were on a narrow road with little traffic and soon came to the village of Baganzola, where they found a bar with coffee and croissants. She was anxious to practice her Italian, and while it sounded proficient to Rick, the signora at the counter struggled.
"A dialect,"
Livy said as they headed for the car.
The Rocca, or fortress, at Fontanellato had been built some 500 years earlier, and it certainly looked impregnable. It was surrounded by a moat and anchored by four massive towers with wide openings for observation and weaponry. Inside, however, there was a marvelous palace with walls covered in art and remarkably decorated rooms. After 15 minutes, Rick had seen enough, but his lady friend was just getting started. When he finally got her back into the car, they continued north, at her direction, to the town of Sorogna. It was situated on fertile plains on the left bank of the river Stirone, and had been the site of many ancient battles, according to their car's historian, who could not digest the details fast enough. As she rattled them off, Rick drifted away to the Bergamo Lions, and especially Signor Maschi, the very agile middle linebacker who, in Rick's opinion, was the key to the game. He thought of all the plays and schemes devised by brilliant coaches to neutralize a great middle linebacker. They rarely worked. The castle at Sorogna, still home to a real prince, dated back only to the 17th century, and after a quick tour, they found lunch at a small deli. Then, onward to San Secondo, famous nowadays for spalla, a boiled ham. The town's castle, built in the 15th century as a fortress, played a role in many important battles.
"Why do these people fight so much?" Rick asked at one point.
Livy shot him a quick answer, but had little interest in the wars. She was more attracted to the art, the furniture, the marble fireplaces, and so on. Rick sneaked away and took a nap under a tree. They finished at Colorno, nicknamed the Little Versailles of the Po. It was a majestic fortress that had been remodeled into a splendid home, complete with vast gardens and courtyards. When they arrived, Livy was just as excited as she'd been 7 hours earlier when they got to the first castle, one that Rick could barely remember. He gamely plodded on through the exhaustive tour, then finally quit.
"Meet me at the bar," he said, and left her alone in a massive hallway, gawking at frescoes high above and lost in another world.
Rick balked on Saturday, and they argued briefly. It was their first dust-up, and both found it amusing. It was over quickly, and neither seemed to hold a grudge, a promising sign. She had in mind a road trip to the south, to Langhirano, through the wine country, with only a couple of important castles to examine.
He had in mind a quiet day, off his feet, as he tried to focus more on Bergamo and less on her legs. They compromised on a plan to stay in town and finish off a couple of churches. He was clear-eyed and rested, primarily because the team had decided to skip the Friday ritual of pizza and buckets of beer at Polipo's. They had hustled through a quick workout in shorts, listened to more game planning from Sam, listened to yet another emotional speech, this one from Pietro, and finally quit at 10 Friday night. They had practiced enough. Saturday night, they gathered at Cafe Montana for the pre-game meal, a 3-hour gastronomic fiesta with Nino on center stage and Carlo roaring in the kitchen. Signor Bruncardo was present and addressed his team. He thanked them for a thrilling season, one that would not, however, be complete unless they thrashed Bergamo tomorrow. There were no women present. The little restaurant was packed with just the players, and this fact led to two raunchy poems and a final farewell, a profanity-laced ode composed by the lyrical Franco and delivered in a hysterical style. Sam sent them home before 11. Chapter 25. Bergamo traveled well. They brought an impressive number of fans who arrived early and loud, unfurled banners, practiced horn blowing and chants, and in general made themselves quite at home at Stadio Lanfranchi. 8 straight Super Bowls bestowed upon them the right to go anywhere in NFL Italy and take over the stadium. Their cheerleaders were dressed appropriately in skimpy gold skirts and knee-high black boots, and this proved to be a distraction for the Panthers during the lengthy pre-game warm-up. Focus was lost, or at least temporarily detoured, as the girls stretched and jiggled and limbered up for the big game. "Why can't we have cheerleaders?" Rick asked Sam when he walked by. "Shut up." Sam stalked around the field, growling at his players, as nervous as any NFL coach before a big game. He chatted briefly with a reporter from the Gazzetta di Parma. A television crew shot some footage, as much of the cheerleaders as of the players. The Panthers fans were not to be outdone. Alex Oliveto had spent the week rounding up the younger players from the flag football leagues, and they packed together at one end of the home stands and were soon yelling at the Bergamo supporters. Many ex-Panthers were there, along with families and friends. Anyone with a passing interest in football Americano had a seat long before kickoff. The locker room was intense, and Sam made no effort to calm his players. Football is a game of emotion, most of it grounded on fear, and every coach wants his team clamoring for violence. He issued the standard warnings against penalties and turnovers and stupid mistakes, then turned them loose. When the teams lined up for the opening kickoff, the stadium was full and noisy. Parma received, and Giancarlo zipped along the far sideline with the return until he was pushed into the Bergamo bench at the 31. Rick trotted out with his offense, outwardly cool, but with a hard knot deep in his stomach. The first 3 plays were scripted, and none was designed to score. Rick called a quarterback sneak, and no translation was needed. Nino was shaking with rage and nicotine deprivation. His glutes were in full arrest, but the snap was quick, and he lunged like a rocket at Maschi, who fought him off and stopped the play after a 1-yard gain.
"Nice run, goat!"
Maschi yelled in a thick accent. The nickname would be thrown at Rick many times in the first half. The second play was another quarterback sneak. It went nowhere, which was the plan. Maschi blitzed hard on every 3rd and long without exception, and some of his sacks were acts of brutality. His tendency, though, perhaps through lack of experience and perhaps because he loved to be seen, was to blitz tall, to come in high. In the huddle, Rick called their special play, kill Maschi. The offense had been running the play for a week now. In the shotgun, with no tailback and 3 wideouts, Franco lined up close behind Carl the Dane at left tackle. He squatted low to hide himself. On the snap, the offensive line double-teamed the tackles, leaving a gaping hole for Signor L.T. Maschi to come crashing through, a straight shot at Rick. He took the bait, and his quickness almost killed him. Rick dropped deep to pass, hoping the play would work before the linebacker assaulted him. As Maschi exploded through the middle, tall and confident, and thrilled for a chance at Rick so soon, Judge Franco suddenly shot up from nowhere and caused a mighty collision between 2 players who each weighed 220 pounds. Franco's helmet landed perfectly, just under Maschi's face mask, ripping off the chin strap and causing the gold Bergamo helmet to shoot high into the air. Maschi flipped, his feet soon chasing his helmet, and when he landed on his head, Sam thought they might have killed him. It was a classic beheading, a super highlight, the type of play that would be repeated a million times on the sports channels in the United States. Perfectly legal, perfectly brutal. Rick missed it because he had the ball with his back to the play. He heard it, though, the crack and crunch of the extremely nasty hit, every bit as violent as something from the real NFL. As the play developed, things became complicated, and when it was over, the referees needed 5 minutes to sort it all out. At least 4 flags were on the field, along with what appeared to be 3 dead bodies. Maskey wasn't moving, and not far away, Franco wasn't either. But there was no penalty on that part of the play. The first flag went down in the secondary. The safety was a little thug named McGregor, a Yank from Gettysburg College, who fancied himself to be from the assassin school of roving safeties. In an attempt to establish turf, intimidate, bully, and simply start the game with the right tone, he delivered a vicious clothesline to Fabrizio as he ran benignly across the field, far away from the action. Fortunately, a referee saw it. Unfortunately, Nino did too, and by the time Nino sprinted to McGregor and knocked him down, there were more flags. Coaches ran onto the field and barely prevented a brawl. The final flags floated down in the area where Rick had been tackled after a 5-yard gain. The cornerback, nicknamed the Professor, had played sparingly at Wake Forest as a youth, and now, in his mid-30s, he was pursuing yet another degree in Italian literature. When he wasn't studying or teaching, he was playing and coaching for the Bergamo Lions. Far from a soft academic, the Professor went for the head and was fond of the cheap shot. If his hamstring was bothering him, it wasn't apparent. After a hard hit on Rick, he yelled like a crazy man. "Great run, Goat! Now throw me a pass!" Rick gave him a shove. The Professor shoved back, and there were flags. While the officials huddled frantically and seemed completely clueless about what to do, the trainers tended to the wounded. Franco was the first up. He jogged to the sideline where he was mobbed by his teammates. Kill Maskey had worked to perfection. On the ground, Maskey's legs were moving, so there was some relief around the stadium. Then his knees bent. The trainer stood, and Maskey bounded to his feet. He walked to the sideline, found a seat on the bench, and began taking oxygen. He would be back, and soon, though his enthusiasm for the blitz would not return that day. Sam was screaming at the referees to eject McGregor, and it was deserved. But they would have to eject Nino as well for throwing a punch. The compromise was a 15-yard penalty against the Lions. First down, Panthers. When Fabrizio saw the penalty being marked off, he slowly got to his feet and went to the bench. No permanent injuries. Everybody would be back. Both sidelines were furious, and all the coaches were yelling at the officials in a heated mixture of languages. Rick was fuming from the encounter with the Professor, so he called his number again. He swept to the right, cut around the end, and went straight for him. The collision was impressive, especially for Rick, the non-hitter, and when he rammed the Professor in front of the Panther bench, his teammates yelled with delight. Gain of 7. The testosterone was pumping now. His entire body throbbed from 2 straight collisions, but his head was clear, and there was no residue from the old concussions. Same play, quarterback sweep right. Claudio got a block on the Professor, and when he spun around, Rick was charging at full speed, head low, helmet aimed at his chest. Another impressive collision. Rick Dockery, a headhunter. "What the hell are you doing?" Sam barked when Rick jogged by. "Moving the ball." If unpaid, Fabrizio would have gone to the locker room and called it a day, but the salary had brought a responsibility that the kid had maturely accepted, and he still wanted to play college ball in the United States. Quitting wouldn't help that dream. He jogged back on the field along with Franco, and the offense was intact. And Rick was tired of running. With Maskey on the bench, Rick worked the middle with Franco, who had vowed on his mother's grave not to fumble, and pitched to Giancarlo around the ends. He bootlegged twice, running for nice gains. On a 2nd and 2 from the 19, he faked to Franco, faked to Giancarlo, sprinted right on another bootleg, then pulled up at the line and hit Fabrizio in the end zone. McGregor was close, but not close enough. "What do you think?" Sam asked Rick as they watched the teams line up for the kickoff. "Watch McGregor. He'll try to break Fabrizio's leg, I guarantee it." "You hearing all that goat shit?" "No, Sam,
I'm deaf. The Bergamo tailback, the one the scouting report said didn't like to hit, grabbed the ball on the third play and managed to hit hard every member of the Panther defense on his way to a beautiful 74-yard gallop that electrified the fans and sent Sam into hysterics. After the kickoff, Mr. Maskey strutted onto the field, but with a bit less spring in his gait. He hadn't been killed after all.
I'll get him, Franco said.
Why not, thought Rick. He called a dive play, handed it to Franco, and watched in horror as the ball was dropped. It somehow got kicked by a churning knee that propelled it high over the line of scrimmage. In the melee that followed, half the players on the field touched the loose ball as it rolled and hopped from pile to pile and finally careened, unpossessed, out of bounds. Still Panthers ball. Gain of 16.
This might be our day, Sam mumbled to no one.
Rick reshifted the offense, spread Fabrizio to the left, and hit him for 8 yards on a down and out. McGregor shoved him out of bounds, but there was no foul. Back to the right, same play for 8 more. The short pass game worked for 2 reasons. Fabrizio was too fast to play tight, so McGregor had to yield space underneath, and Rick's arm was too strong to be stopped in the short game. He and Fabrizio had spent hours on the timing patterns. The quick outs, slants, hooks, curls. The key would be how long Fabrizio was willing to take shots from McGregor after he caught Rick's passes. The Panthers scored late in the first quarter when Giancarlo leaped over a wave of tacklers, landed on his feet, then sprinted 10 yards to the end zone. It was an amazing, fearless, acrobatic maneuver, and the Parma faithful went berserk. Sam and Rick shook their heads. Only in Italy. The Panthers led, 14-7. The punting game took over in the second quarter as both offenses sputtered. Maskey was slowly shaking off the cobwebs and returning to form. Some of his plays were impressive, at least from the safety of the deep pocket where Rick had a good view. Maskey did not, however, seem inclined to return to his kamikaze blitzing. Franco was always lurking nearby, near his quarterback. With a minute to go before the half and the Panthers up by a touchdown, the game turned on its most crucial play. Rick, who hadn't thrown an interception in 5 games, finally did so. It was a curl to Fabrizio, who was open, but the ball sailed high. Gregor caught it at midfield and had a good shot at the end zone. Rick bolted toward the sideline, as did Giancarlo. Fabrizio caught McGregor enough to spin him and slow him, but he stayed on his feet and kept running. Giancarlo was next, and when McGregor juked him, he was suddenly on a collision course with the quarterback. A quarterback's dream is to murder the safety who just picked off his pass. A dream that never comes true because most quarterbacks really don't want to get near a safety who has the ball and really wants to score. It's just a dream. But Rick had been smashing helmets all day, and for the first time since high school, he was looking for contact. Suddenly, he was a roving hitman, someone to be feared. With McGregor in the crosshairs, Rick left his feet, launched himself, abandoned any and all concern for his own body and safety, and aimed at his target. The impact was loud and violent. McGregor fell back as if he'd been shot in the head. Rick was dazed for a second, but jumped to his feet as if it were just another kill. The crowd was stunned, but also thrilled by such mayhem. Giancarlo fell on the ball, and Rick chose to run out the clock. As they left the field for halftime, Rick glanced at the Bergamo bench and saw McGregor walking gingerly with a trainer, much like a boxer who'd been flattened.
"Did you try to kill him?"
Livy would ask later, not in disgust, but certainly not in admiration.
"Yes," Rick answered.
McGregor did not answer the bell, and the second half quickly became the Fabrizio show. The professor stepped over and immediately got burned on a post. If he played tight, Fabrizio ran by him. If he played loose, which he preferred to do, Rick tossed the 10 yarders that quickly added up. The Panthers scored twice in the third quarter. In the fourth, the Lions engaged the strategy of a double team, half of it being the professor, who was by then quite winded and by any means overmatched, and the other half being an Italian, who was not only too small, but too slow. When Fabrizio outran them on a fly and hauled in a long, beautiful pass that Rick had launched from midfield, the score was 35-14. And the celebrating began. The Parma fans lit fireworks, chanted nonstop, waved huge soccer-style banners, and someone tossed the obligatory smoke bomb. Across the field, The Bergamo fans were still and bewildered. If you win 67 in a row, you're never supposed to lose. Winning becomes automatic. A loss in a tight game would be heartbreaking enough, but this was a romp. They rolled up their banners, packed their stuff. Their cute little cheerleaders were silent and very sad. Many of the Lions had never lost, and as a whole, they did so gracefully. Mosky, surprisingly, was a good-natured soul who sat on the grass with his shoulder pads off and chatted with several of the Panthers long after the game was over. He admired Franco for the brutal hit, and when he heard about the kill Mosky play, he took it as a compliment. And he admitted that the long winning streak had created too much pressure, too many expectations. In a way, there was relief in getting it out of the way. They would meet again soon, Parma and Bergamo, probably in the Super Bowl, and the Lions would return to form. That was his promise. Normally, the Americans from both teams met after the game for a quick hello. It was nice to hear from home and compare notes on players each had met along the way, but not today. Rick resented the goat calling and hustled off the field. He showered and changed quickly, celebrated just long enough, then hurried away with Livy in tow. He'd been dizzy in the fourth quarter, and a headache was settling in at the base of his skull. Too many blows to the head. Too much football. Chapter 26. They slept till noon in their tiny room in a small albergo near the beach, then gathered their towels, sunscreen, water bottles, and paperbacks, and stumbled, still groggy, to the edge of the Adriatic Sea, where they set up camp for the afternoon. It was early June and hot, the tourist season fast approaching, but the beach was not yet crowded.
"You need sun," Livy said as she covered herself with oil.
Her top came off, leaving nothing but a few strings where they were absolutely necessary.
"I guess that's why we're here at the beach," he said. "And I haven't seen a single tanning salon in Parma.
Not enough Americans."
They'd left Parma after the Friday practice and the Friday pizza at Polipo's. The drive to Ancona took 3 hours, then another half hour south along the coast to the Conera Peninsula, and finally to the small resort town of Cirolo. It was after 3 a.m. when they checked in. Livy had booked the room, found the directions, and knew where the restaurants were. She loved the details of travel. A waiter finally noticed them and trudged over for a tip. They ordered sandwiches and beer and waited a good hour for both. Livy kept her nose stuck in a paperback, while Rick managed to drift in and out of consciousness. Or, if fully awake, he would shift to his right side and admire her, topless and sizzling in the sun. Her cell phone buzzed from somewhere deep in the beach bag. She grabbed it, stared at the caller ID, and decided not to answer.
"My father,"
she said with distaste, then returned to her mystery. Her father had been calling, as had her mother and sister. Livy was 10 days past due from her year of study abroad and had dropped more than one hint that she might not come home. Why should she? Things were much safer in Italy. Though she was still guarded with some of the details, Rick had learned the basics. Her mother's family was a strain of Savannah blue bloods, miserable people, according to Livy's succinct descriptions, and they had never accepted her father because he was from New England. Her parents had met at the University of Georgia, the family school. Their wedding had been hotly opposed in private by her family, and this had only inspired her mother to go on with it. There was infighting at many levels, and the marriage was doomed from the beginning. The fact that he was a prominent brain surgeon who earned lots of money meant little to his in-laws, who actually had very little cash, but had been forever blessed with the status of family money. Her father worked brutal hours and was thoroughly consumed by his career. He ate at the office, slept at the office, and evidently was soon enjoying the companionship of nurses at the office. This went on for years, and in retribution, her mother began seeing younger men. Much younger. Her sister, an only sibling, was in therapy by the age of 10. A totally dysfunctional family, was Livy's assessment. She couldn't wait to leave for boarding school at 14. She picked one in Vermont, as far away as possible, and for 4 years dreaded the holidays. Summers were spent in Montana, where she worked as a camp counselor. For this summer, upon her return from Florence, her father had arranged an internship with a hospital in Atlanta, where she would work with brain-damaged accident victims. He planned for her to be a doctor, no doubt a great one like himself. She had no plans, except those that would take her far from the routes chosen by her parents. The divorce trial was scheduled for late September, with a lot of money at stake. Her mother was demanding that she testify on her behalf, specifically about an incident 3 years earlier when Livy surprised her father at the hospital and caught him groping a young female doctor. Her father was playing the money card. The divorce had been raging for almost 2 years, and Savannah couldn't wait for the public showdown between the great doctor and the prominent socialite. Livy was desperate to avoid it. She did not want her senior year of college wrecked by a sleazy brawl between her parents. Rick was given this background in brief narratives, almost reluctantly, usually whenever her phone rang and she was forced to deal with her family. He listened patiently, and she was grateful to have a sounding board. Back in Florence, her roommates were too absorbed with their own lives. He was thankful for his rather dull parents and their simple lives in Davenport. Her phone rang again. She grabbed it, grunted, then took off down the beach with the phone stuck to her head. Rick watched and admired every step. Other men adjusted themselves in beach chairs to have a look. He guessed it was her sister because she took the call and quickly walked away as if to spare him the details. He wouldn't know, though. When she returned, she said, "Sorry," then rearranged herself in the sun and began reading. Fortunately for Rick, the Allies leveled Ancona at the end of the war, and thus it was light on castles and palazzi. According to Livy's collection of guidebooks, there was only an old cathedral worth looking at, and she was not keen to see it. Sunday, they slept late again, skipped the sightseeing, and finally found the football field. The Panthers arrived by bus at 1:30. Rick was alone in the locker room, waiting for them. Livy was alone in the bleachers, reading an Italian Sunday newspaper.
"Glad you could make it," Sam growled at his quarterback. "So, you're in your usual happy mood, coach?"
"Oh yes, a 4-hour bus ride always makes me happy." The great victory over Bergamo had yet to wear off, and Sam, as usual, was expecting a disaster against the Dolphins of Ancona. An upset, and the Panthers would miss the playoffs. He had pushed them hard Wednesday and Friday, but they were still reveling in their stunning disruption of the great streak. The Gazzetta di Parma ran a front-page story, complete with a large action shot of Fabrizio racing down the field. There was another story on Tuesday, one that featured Franco, Nino, Pietro, and Giancarlo. The Panthers were the hottest team in the league, and they were winning big with real Italian footballers. Only their quarterback was American, and so on. But Ancona had won only a single game and lost 6, most by wide margins. The Panthers were flat, as expected, but they had also slaughtered Bergamo, and that in itself was intimidating. Rick and Fabrizio hooked up twice in the first quarter, and Giancarlo cartwheeled and belly-flopped for 2 more touchdowns in the second. Early in the fourth, Sam cleared the bench, and Alberto took over on offense. The regular season came to an end with the ball at midfield. Both teams huddled over it like a rugby scrum as the clock ticked down to the final seconds. The players ripped off their dirty jerseys and pads and spent half an hour shaking hands and making promises about next year. The Ancona tailback was from Council Bluffs, Iowa, and had played at a small college in Minnesota. He had seen Rick play 7 years earlier in a big Iowa-Wisconsin game, and they had a delightful time replaying it. One of Rick's better college efforts. It was nice to talk to someone with the same accent. They chatted about players and coaches they had known. The tailback had a flight the next day and couldn't wait to get home. Rick, of course, would stay through the playoffs, and beyond that, had no plans. They wished each other well and promised to catch up later. Bergamo, evidently anxious to start a new streak, beat Rome by 6 touchdowns and finished the season at 7-1. Parma and Bologna tied for second at 6-2 and would play each other in the semifinals. The big news of the day was the upset at Bolzano. The Rhinos from Milan scored on the final play and sneaked into the playoffs. They worked on their tans for another day, then grew tired of Cirolo. They drifted north, stopping for a day and a night at the medieval village of Urbino. Livy had now seen 13 of the 20 regions and was hinting strongly at a prolonged tour that would include the other 7. But with an expired visa, how far could she go? She preferred not to talk about it, and she did a remarkable job ignoring her family, as long as they ignored her. As they drove along the back roads of Umbria and Tuscany, she studied the maps and had a knack for finding tiny villages and wineries and ancient palazzi. She knew the history of the regions, the wars and conflicts, the rulers and their city-states, the influence of Rome and its decline. She could glance at a small village cathedral and say, Baroque, late 17th century, or Romanesque, early 12th century. And for good measure, she might add, but the dome was added 100 years later by a classical architect. She knew the great artists, and not just their work, but also their hometowns and training and eccentricities and all the important details of their careers. She knew Italian wine and made sense of the endless variety of grapes from the regions. If they were really thirsty, she would find a hidden winery. They would do a quick tour, then settle in for a free sample. They finally made it back to Parma, late Wednesday afternoon, in time for a very long practice. Livy stayed at the apartment. Home. While Rick dragged himself to Stadio Lanfranchi to prepare once again for the Bologna Warriors. Chapter 27. The oldest panther was Tommaso, or simply Tommy. He was 42 and had been playing for 20 years. It was his intention, shared much too often in the locker room, to retire only after Parma won its first Super Bowl. A few of his teammates thought he was long past retirement age, and his desire to hang on was just another good reason for the Panthers to hurry and win the big one. Tommy played defensive end and was effective for about a third of any game. He was tall and weighed around 200 pounds, but sort of quick off the ball and a decent pass rusher. On running plays, though, he was no match for a charging lineman or fullback, and Sam was careful how he used Tommy. There were several Panthers, the older guys, who needed only a few snaps per game. Tommy was a career civil servant of some variety, with a nice secure job and a thoroughly hip apartment in the center of town. Nothing was old but the building. Inside the apartment, Tommy had carefully removed any concession to age and history. The furniture was glass, chrome, and leather. The floors were unpolished blonde oak. The walls were covered with baffling contemporary art, and arranged nicely throughout was every conceivable high-tech entertainment apparatus. His lady for the evening, certainly not a wife, fit in superbly with the decor. Her name was Maddalena. As tall as Tommy, but 100 pounds lighter and at least 15 years younger. As Rick said hello to her, Tommy hugged and pecked Livy and acted as though he might just lead her away to the bedroom. Livy had caught the attention of the Panthers, and why not? A beautiful young American girl living with their quarterback, right there in Parma. Being red-blooded Italians, they could not help but wiggle their way closer. There had always been invitations to dinner, but since her arrival, Rick was really in demand. Rick managed to pry Livy away and began admiring Tommy's collection of trophies and football memorabilia. There was a photo of Tommy with a young football team. In Texas, Tommy said, near Waco, I go every year in August to practice with the team. High school? Si. I take my vacation and do what you call two-a-days, no?
Oh, yes, two-a-days. Always in August.
Rick was stunned. He had never met anyone who voluntarily submitted himself to the horrors of August two-a-days. And by August, the Italian season was over. So why bother with all that brutal conditioning?
I know, it's crazy, Tommy was saying.
Yes, it is. You still go?
Oh, no. 3 years ago I quit. My wife, the second one, did not approve.
At this, he cast his eyes warily at Maddalena for some reason, then continued.
She left, but I was too old. Those boys are just 17, too young for a 40-year-old man, don't you think?
No doubt. Rick moved on, still flabbergasted at the thought of Tommy or anyone spending his vacation in the Texas heat, running wind sprints and slamming into blocking sleds. There was a rack of perfectly matched leather notebooks, each about an inch thick, with a year embossed in gold, one for each of Tommy's 20 seasons.
This is the first, Tommy said.
Page one was a glossy Panther game schedule, with the scores added by hand. 4 wins, 4 losses. Then game programs, newspaper articles, and pages of photographs. Tommy pointed to himself in a group shot and said,
That's me, number 82. Back then even, 30 pounds bigger.
He looked huge, and Rick almost said some of that bulk would be welcome now. But Tommy was a fashionista, dapper, and always looking good. No doubt losing the extra weight had much to do with his love life. They flipped through a few of the yearbooks, and the seasons began to blur.
Never a Super Bowl, Tommy said,
more than once. He pointed to an empty space in the center of a bookshelf and said,
This is the special place, Rick. This is where I put a big picture of my Panthers just after we win the Super Bowl. You will be here, Rick. No,
definitely. He flung an arm around Rick's shoulder.